filled with glass, sniffing my cocaine and pain. I like noses full of snot, dead things when they rot, belching just for fun and scum. And I like you too. In my arm and harm. I like spearing little ducks, eating little frogs, screaming in the night in fright. And I like you too. I like knuckles when they pop, screaming at a cop, bugs around my ears and tears. I like stepping on a nail, spitting in a pail, cooking me a rat and bats. And I like you too. Lizards in the grass, smelling raunchy gas, slipping on some ice and lice. I like catching me the flu, snails in the big stew, armpits when they're wet and sweat. And I like you too.
I'm here with Sarah Staton and her daughter, Ozzy, and we're in her home in South London.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we're going to hear Ozzy a little bit in the interview too. And we're going to talk a little bit about Sarah's work.
Yeah.
Sarah, you make work as an artist on your own, and also you've been making superstores for how many years now?
3 years.
And I think you're just off to New York to do another one quite soon.
Yeah, I'm just going to open Superstore Deluxe, which is going to be the most deluxe version of the Superstore project to date. And it's opening in Tribeca in a new project space called Up & Co. in December.
Superstores are kind of inverse of an art shop. And I'd like to talk about that, but I'd also like to talk about the work that you do as an artist, as an individual. Something that links both the Superstore project and the work you do and exhibit yourself under your own name. Something that links those two things is a refusal to take certain aspects of the commercial art market for granted. I wondered about the kind of sense of making work on your own in a studio situation, and if you would feel that that was a sensible thing to do if you weren't also doing the Superstores.
I think Superstore is a very good vehicle for reaching other people within the art world system. Definitely making work in a studio in a totally isolated way would hold no interest for me, and to me work doesn't really exist until it's interacted in some way with an audience. So in that sense it's pretty important. Superstore's been important for me in that sense.
The information that you gather through doing the Superstores, I think you've called it a vehicle for investigation. You also process this information within the production of your own paintings.
Yes, up to a point. It's kind of an oblique relationship, but yes, I think that kind of thing, that relationship does exist.
Perhaps you could describe a little bit the history of Superstore.
Sure. The Superstore grew out of a project I was doing with... I'd made a small series of work, these little objects, and I packed them up into boxes, and I did a kind of travelling sales project, which came out of a kind of life experience, because I'd had a job in publishing involving sales. I had these small objects existing, and I was thinking, trying to think of a way that they could go into the art system. And Sarah Lucas and Tracy Emin had a really fantastic shop in Bethnal Green, but their shop was really only for their own work, so that wasn't really an option. So I kind of thought, if one has objects to sell in the real world, and you have no shop or no access into a shop, then you still have the opportunity to sell by either kind of taking goods to a market, just taking goods to a market and lying them on the ground and just attempting to sell them in that way. And then you also have the possibility of doing travelling sales, just going around making appointments. So I did an experiment in Brick Lane Market, which was pretty much unsuccessful. I sold one piece to an artist, to Gary Hume, who happened to walk past and who knew me and who bought a piece, which was really exciting. But other people who came by, they were all wanting to know what was in these boxes, and they were asking if it was gold. And when I said it wasn't gold, it was like art, or I said it was sculpture, they just like rushed off, because they obviously were looking for gold to buy and sell. So they had their own thing, and it was kind of an interesting thing, because I never realised before that in Brick Lane Market there are people who actually work the market, and they go there in the morning and they buy, and then later on during the morning they sell. So that was quite interesting. Following that, because I didn't think that was worth pursuing, I made appointments with galleries, and I took my objects around in this sort of Duchampian box and sold work to galleries in this manner, and it was pretty nice experiment.
I remember you did some travelling sales at art fairs as well.
I did a bit at art fairs, and I guess that was kind of more difficult, because the prices of the work was just like uninteresting for most people. It was just like far too cheap. So, but the work that I sold, I'd made these collections, which were cigarette butts and coins, and that I made them because they represented stuff that you could find. They're kind of objects that are surplus to capitalist system, because they're discarded, but they still have a use value. Cigarettes, tobacco has a use value, and you know, if you find butts, you can, if you are that desperate, you can you know, roll your own cigarettes from them, and obviously small change adds up to bigger change, so the older saying goes. And then I went to Birmingham one day, and there were all these teenagers like hanging out outside this off license and by a phone box, and the floor was strewn with coppers, and none of them were picking them up. And I thought that was kind of interesting. It was obviously a status thing that they obviously didn't have like an enormous amount of money, but it seemed to be the status thing that they were just like would diss this small change. And I thought that was quite sensible, really, because there's not a lot you can do with it, really.
Cigarette ends featured in as a kind of motif, or something that you painted in the paintings in the exhibition you had recently in Soho House. So perhaps if we can talk about that now, that will help sort of demonstrate the kinds of links that there are between Superstore and work that you produce yourself in a studio. Apart from the cigarette butts, I know there was also a sort of underlying theme running through all the paintings, which were quite a small format, if I seem to remember, which was a mapping of collecting and collectors in the contemporary art world. That's something that is generally kept fairly secret between dealers and artists and collectors. It's a sort of unspoken etiquette. What was underpinning your thoughts at the moment of coming to make those drawings, where you made this kind of Treasure Island map of collectors all over the world?
Well, it kind of started from my perspective in the UK. Well, there's kind of a lot to say about this, really. The collector's drawing started off with a kind of perspective of the UK, which is sort of disproportionately large, because there's the Saatchi collection is obviously very public, and he has a lot of buying power, and he's a very important figure in the UK, within the UK. And then there are other collectors who have probably smaller collections or more discreet collections. And so it would seem in the UK that you could make this kind of map whereby there'd be like this small pile of stones at the bottom, and then there'd be this like sort of huge rock on the top. And it, you know, I'm not kind of part of that collection, so, and this is only my perspective, and it may be wildly inaccurate, but it can sometimes seem like it could be a precarious situation to be involved in that collection, because so you could make this diagram, and it seemed kind of an interesting thing to do.
As we were saying, discussing who collects what in a public sense to the audience for your artwork is not such a usual thing to do. It takes on the nature of a kind of expose.
I'd say I prefer the idea of demystification rather than expose. And I would say that I'm not actually that interested in art that is totally about the system that it's that it's involved in. So I think the most interesting thing about the whole thing is actually the map rather than the subject. I think the subject is of interest, but it's like a small deal rather than a big deal.
In the way it describes relationships,
yes,
rather than affirming statistics.
Yeah, I think so. You know, maybe time will show me that actually it is of more interest. I mean, big collectors of history, their collections are really fascinating.
What are the differences that you're having to consider as far as doing a superstore in this new space in New York is concerned?
There's probably about 60 artists involved in this one, and a lot of them are English, but I think that will change and a lot more Americans will be involved over time. And the idea is that we try and run it right through 97. There's going to be an opening show, and that will go on through Christmas and into the new year. And then this superstore is like, it's in this new project space, and it's going to be contained within a big cabinet, and in the opening show it'll all spill out, and then it'll go back into the cabinet, and then there'll be kind of another, some sort of opening, and maybe another show in the spring of next year, and it'll kind of keep changing and diversifying, and we'll see what happens.
We talked a little bit about different spaces that you'd use to work in, like the building on Charing Cross Road. I know that you were involved and very influential in beginning the space, I suppose alternative space, called Milch in 1989. You're not involved there now, and obviously Milch has been through a lot of changes, but I wondered how you saw your experience at Milch and how you think that the idea of alternative space generally fits into things now compared with 1989 when you first began Milch.
Prior to the space in Guildford Street being called Milch, I did a show with people I'd been in college with, Niels Norman and Merlin Carpenter. In a way, it was mainly Niels' show, and I was kind of involved because I lived in the space, and so we made a show, and then it became Milch, and then I kind of removed myself from the project because of personality clashes. But I was involved in shows there, and it was a really fantastic, very early alternative space. And I think at that point, City Racing was operating, and the Freeze show and Building One had happened, but I don't really think there was anything else that I was aware of going on at that point. And now there's an absolute proliferation of alternative spaces, and I don't even know how many there are, and it's like mind-boggling.
So I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the themes that recur and repeat and carry on in the pieces that you make for your own exhibitions, and how the themes, those themes relate to the kind of things that you're investigating in Superstore, and particularly thinking of the most recent exhibition you did at Soho House in London, but also of earlier pieces that I've seen of yours at the Serpentine in 1991, and in those early Milch shows as well. If there's any link that you'd like to make between those early pieces, Superstore, now?
Well, I guess that I'm kind of quite restless, so my work does jump around quite a lot, but I think the Serpentine piece that I made was this huge flag made of broken bottles on the lawn. It was really enormous, and I wanted to make something monumental scale, kind of representative of the state, and it's kind of a thing with living in England that it can become a kind of subject. And a lot of artists in England work with the Union Jack, and I don't think that's something that would happen if you were like French or German. I've never seen that really particularly from other European countries, and it happens with America, like the Jasper Johns flags are pretty strong pieces, and it happens a bit in pop art, but that's kind of, I think it's something that's quite weird about England, that motif can be used again and again. And so I made this really monumental piece, and a kind of monumental scale to represent the state, and this kind of like decaying, beautiful country or whatever. And then I'm involved in the show in December of this year, and I'm going to do a St. George's flag, which will be kind of bleeding, and that's going to be another floor piece. And I think that nationalism is a much bigger agenda than on globally than it was 7 years ago, whatever it was, when I made that first piece. So it's kind of like from the Union Jack, I'm now going to make this St. George's cross. So I'm kind of interested in like power structures, I guess. So that's kind of a recurring theme to do, to make some things that are kind of in relation to that. So the Soho House work, these small paintings that I did, were, I had this idea of, I also really, really interested in kind of where meaning lies and in how a word can have many meanings. So the title of that show was Burger, 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 as in like mountains, as in bourgeois, who, the people who make piles of money or whatever, and like trashy like meat snack. So I had all these small canvases with these various mountains.
When you make a map of collectors or reveal a gallery as a shop, as you do in Superstore, how do you set about negotiating that sort of borderline moment where what is essentially a critical intention could also become a kind of repetition of the subject, like you could create another smaller shop which would be functioning in the same way as the gallery-like shop which you were setting out to kind of unpick in the first place?
I wouldn't say that I could try and unpick a gallery shop, because effectively what I do is a shop in a gallery, but it's more like to do something that's completely opposite to a sort of shopetropolis superstore. And those have only developed in the UK in the last 5 or 6 years or something, these like out-of-town huge shopping centres. And Superstore is like so completely different from that, and it's like to put the super back in store or something like that. And to try and maintain a critical position is pretty difficult, and you want to try and like stay on the fence in this situation or something. And it's just, you don't really know if you can do it or you can't, but you try. And then there's this fantastic little quote from Henrik Ibsen, which is, one should never put on one's best trousers to go out to battle for freedom and truth.
I'm talking with Alan Johnston in the Listen Gallery, the upper room at the Listen Gallery, where he has at present an installation of works. You mentioned, Alan, the mirror theory. Could you perhaps say something a bit more about that in relation to these works?
I think the works are very, you know, an extension of not just a kind of physical aspect of material, but a bodily sensibility. And this comes, you know, right into the notions of the tactility of the objects. The idea of the loop as a kind of transcendental device in, you know, sometimes in ancient cultures, sometimes, you know, it occurs in particularly in contemporary music, as I suppose it's close to the idea of repetition as an enheightening thing. Though what I'm doing here is I'm containing repetition within a kind of loop sensation. And there was an actual fact, a letter I wrote to you, which I was actually just going to read a bit about, which covers this point very adequately. Loop is in one sense the coming to an end of a cycle of work. It represents the latter part of the third engagement with the House of Wittgenstein, that part being working directly within it, and a clarification of drawing tactility in space. And to that end, there is something that I noted in an essay by Donald Cuspet, when he's in actual fact talking about the whole notion of this as a form, a 20th century or late 20th century form, and I've got it here. It says, Donald Cuspet writes on Joseph Mashek on abstraction in terms of Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach, and the quote is, when an abstract work of art makes a strange loop, an effect of transcendence is produced, that is, whenever by moving upwards or downwards through the levels of some hierarchical system, we unexpectedly find ourselves to be back where we started. And I suppose the limitation placed on these works is in actual fact circumlocutory, which, you know, ties up, you know, you were talking earlier on about the mirror theory. that is a non-progressive idea, an idea that is tied up, you know, with the Vicovian notion or Kubler's notion of a circular context of time, not a progressive one. Mm-hmm. So these pieces are seen within this loop phenomenon. I mean, in that sense, in a strange kind of way, they're sort of static. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, the animism of stasis is something that I find particularly interesting. And this sort of takes you into all sorts of implicatory notions about, I mean, like, one thing is zinging back in my head, this is this a quotation from Benjamin Buchlow about the matter of factness of material, which is, I suppose, really exactly the opposite of my view. There is this animus within the material which is kind of enlightened by touch. I mean, so that, in that case, these works are very anthropomorphic. You know.
Could we put it this way, that there is a sense in which you are seeking in the work to make a philosophical statement, well, by means of your actual involvement with material?
Yes. And to that end, I've written a wee thing here, which is... This wasn't written for this, but I was thinking one morning, so I wrote this down. It's called Paraphrases. Like McLaughlin, that is John McLaughlin, I can see no guiding principle behind my work, no logic, yet I perceive a right and wrong on the execution of a piece. This comes when it attains a benign self-deprecatory aloofness, you might say an independence, a life denoting really a calmness with a peculiar quirk, giving a sense of a self-aware totality, and that essential aspect, the ultimate non-utility, being in the end the highest utility. Then I think that the work can bring to the viewer without force, but with a detached curiosity, a neutral, though stoically involved, sense of themselves. This, I may stress, may happen through exploring the work's resolute passivity, observing perhaps the space between the lines and the ensuing ambivalence about where the space actually occurs, that is, in the spatial sense part of the body. Perhaps this is the common sense. No, I mean, that's sort of, I suppose, really is looking at the work. That's what I think, or that's what I see or touch in it.
Can we relate what you've just written, that statement you've just written, to Wittgenstein's architecture and the Wittgenstein house? Because, as you've said earlier, this work, in a sense, continues, is part of that loop which included the exhibition at the Wittgenstein house, or the installation, I should say, at the Wittgenstein house in Vienna, and the installation at Inverleith House in Edinburgh the following year. So this work, which is a year on from that, is, as I said, it's contained in a sense within that same loop, isn't it, that you were talking
yeah.
about? It's part of a continuing body, if you like, of interventions, of statements, interventions in... When I say intervention here, I think I mean interventions into the matter of the world, and the abstraction from the matter of the world, wood, paint, and so on, of objects which carry some sort of philosophical charge of the kind you've been talking about.
There is that, but there's also, inside all this, I suppose really, for me, the Wittgenstein house has been like a secret for me. And in a sense, it was a kind of... I couldn't really... It just fascinated me, but because I couldn't really get it to work relative to my conception of Wittgenstein as a linguistic philosopher. And gradually, I sort of began to see that really it wasn't. And this, for me, was a phenomenal discovery. And it was a discovery in the sense that thought is plastic. It's tactile. It's a bodily activity. And... I ran at this with an enthusiasm of, you know, discovery. And I suppose that propelled me into making a qualification. I mean, that's a terrifically cheeky thing to say about Wittgenstein, but the notion that there was this phenomenal plasticity in his thought, which was the house. So the pieces that I made for that, in a sense, were... I suppose really an addition to the nature of what the house was, in the sense that how is it that Joe Maschek described the works as non-mimetic? And, you know, going back to this idea of animus and the sort of, how did I describe it in this little bit? A self-deprecatory aloofness, an independence. I mean, I felt in a sense that almost, I've had this feeling twice in making work, when I've said that that was enough. I mean, I remember I made a wall drawing in Dusseldorf, and this was in Conrad Fischer's gallery, and I said, well, if nothing else happens, I've done that. In the same sort of sense about doing the show in the Haus Wittgenstein, or doing the installation, or correction, or whatever, there was that sense as well. But then suddenly a whole thing opened up when I saw the implications of, like, the beacon of Inverleith House, its position inside a kind of scientism, a speculative scientism, that was very much part of the Wittgenstein was very much part of this ongoing tradition. So it sort of opened other doors. I felt, in a sense, there was a finality about what I did in the house. But it opened other doors.
There was a sense in which the work you placed inside the Haus Wittgenstein constituted a modification of space and plasticity in that house. And it was a way, in that sense, of engaging with that manifestation of the Wittgensteinian outlook, if you like, that is there in the house. And could we say, I mean, I think one of the things that makes sometimes difficult to talk about the work is precisely that it is about, if we can use that word, or what it relates to or engages with, things beyond the linguistic, beyond language, and that in that sense it relates to that fantastic final proposition of Tractatus, you know, of that of which we cannot speak thereof.
We have it in the bag downstairs.
Okay. Of that of which we cannot speak thereof, we must be silent. Mm-hmm. People have taken that to mean that there's a limit to language, or that.
That's exactly what I felt about making the pieces in there. That I was contributing beyond that, visually and in a tactile sense. That this was what Wittgenstein said. You know, that there is this further thing which is outside the limits of language, and that was for me. Just a phenomenal charge to do this installation.
The positivist take on Tractatus and on Wittgenstein was, of course, that he was saying there was nothing beyond language. In fact, what he was saying is that there is everything beyond language, a huge amount a great deal beyond language, which is unassimilable to language and inaccessible to language itself. But I think the house, for you, perhaps represented the way in which the plastic could engage with this other reality, with the reality
exactly,
beyond the language.
Exactly. There is also, you know, there is another kind of spatial context to the overall body of work that I've made. And there is this notion of, as Kenneth White calls it, pelagic ascesis, you know, a wandering, throwing yourself to, how would you say, the winds of fortune. And that is a very strong, another very strong charge that I got about, there you are being on the periphery, the far northwest of Europe, and looking into the kind of highly constructed and, I would say, monumental world of Middle Europa, you know, Vienna, and seeing connections in this sort of interesting kind of spatial way, in the sense that the actual physical movement in space from Edinburgh to Vienna fascinated me. And I love that, you know, the quotation from the Odyssey of the wine dark sea, the sort of moving wine dark sea where Ulysses says to his crew, east and west mean nothing. Now, there is a strong east-west flow in my, you know, the nature of what I do, where I make the work. And I think it's one thing about it is very interesting how, in a sense, the West wants to inhibit its reflection. It doesn't think of its... The West doesn't think of itself as having a tradition, a kind of native, organic tradition of reflection. And I think this is one of the constructs of the kind of logical positivist limitation on, I would say, experience, that reflection is not part of us, and it breeds a kind of artificial thing where people say to me, "Oh, you've been very influenced by Japan," and I just say, "Oh, fucking bullshit!" You know, it's as Ulysses said, "East and West mean nothing," and I think the continuity of contact between systems is a lot more ancient, you know, in terms of anthropological modes of influence in either dimension.
We've talked about the Wittgenstein House and the way in which you saw that as having, you saw the opportunity to show and to make an installation at Inverleith House in Edinburgh, itself being on a mound, itself being a sort of beacon of the Enlightenment, in a garden in the botanical gardens, which are devoted to some sort of to the attempt to classify and understand the world and so on. Where does London figure in this universe? I know that on the stairs coming up to the gallery there's a very small work, a small wall work, which was one of the things that you put into the House Wittgenstein. So it connects, and as I said, this body of work you see as being within that loop, as being somehow connected. I wondered if, in what way you felt that showing here in London, in this gallery even, related to that program, if you like.
Well, I suppose, in the context of being in London, I suppose this is a sort of beacon of, as somebody described, high modernism. And to that extent, you know, the analogical relationships are very much within that fold. I mean, the complexity of a city of this scale, of course, allows for deviations from the English model. And I think, you know, Nicholas's role in over the last 30 years has been, in actual fact, to be that sort of beacon of contact or context.
Do you feel that living and working in Edinburgh gives you an advantage in that respect?
That's another story. In a sense, I suppose really you're talking about influence. I mean, when I was a kid, I was very, very influenced by Ian Hamilton Finlay, in the sense that I got a world view. I mean, it was there anyway, but Ian more or less made me think of... It was global. You know, you were sort of on the globe. You weren't at a periphery. So you start to think in a different way.
I mean, I was thinking in cultural and to some extent in geographical terms, that and to perhaps even topographical, that Edinburgh is such a distinctive city. But I mean, you have a whole history, a philosophical history, I think, which it informs your work and which is associated with Edinburgh and with its university. It is an intensely tactile city, isn't it? I mean, the presence of the volcanic rock, the presence of Arthur's Seat, at the very heart of the city, as it were. You know, the fact that you can't travel anywhere in Edinburgh without being aware of this extraordinary earth, this extraordinary mineral actuality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this gives rise to a phenomenal ambivalence, intellectual ambivalence, which various people have written about nature and man. And it's one of those things, I suppose, that you cannot not notice when you're there. And I suppose maybe that's part and parcel of the makeup of the mindset for the city, you know, which I'm very much part of.
The metallic sounds on the next interview are from the clicking of Franco B's gold teeth.
My name's Gray Watson. I'm with Franco B in his flat near Waterloo in London, surrounded by artworks of his making and a sort of environment almost in the flat. Franco, we'll begin, if that's okay with you, talking about some performances, and in particular, was it the last performance you did, I'm Not Your Babe?
I'm Not Your Babe, part one and part two, yeah, at the ICA.
The last two performances were at the ICA. You'd done part one before at the ICA,
yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done part one for the first time in April 96, or May 96 actually, and then I decided that I wanted to do part two, but I couldn't do part two too far apart, so I decided to do two nights.
One immediately after the other.
Yeah, so it was like one immediately, one up, but yeah, very much the day after, because I felt I needed the, one needed the aftermath of the first night to be able to do part two. There wouldn't have been the residues, you know, the byproduct of the first night is the blood on the floor. I wanted to use that visually for the second performance, where it doesn't matter if you didn't see the first performance, but what happens when the curtain opens, you see blood and you don't know where it comes from. Although I'm bleeding, the blood is from the night before. The set is very much from the night before. And also, it's very much about the process is kind of reverse, you know, you use the same setup from the first night, except you're going, in a sense, you're going backwards, you know, especially with the light in the first night, there's a light that comes on every minute. So after 12 minutes, you have a 12, very, very bright stage. On the second night, it starts like that, and it goes backwards to when you don't have no lights, you know? And the second up is very similar, except there is not a break in... There's not a break, actually a physical, an interval is only, it goes into black for 45 seconds and then it goes into the different sequence, color sequence, which is red, white, yellow and blue.
That's right, because in part one, there are already, in a sense, two sections of part one.
Yes,
yes. With, as you say, an interval in between.
Yes, in part one is very much that you're having two sketches, but you use the byproduct of the first sketch to be able to do the second one.
Specifically, in the first sketch, you were bleeding.
Yes.
From the inside of your elbows.
Yes, from my main veins.
Main veins in the arms.
In the arms.
Losing a lot of blood.
Yeah, using just over a pint the first night.
Right.
And then... in about 12 minutes, and then you have an interval, and then when the second sketch is where I'm lying in the, you know, because of the two arms are spread apart, it makes two small little ponds, you know, a little kind of, if you can call it pond, you know.
Ponds or puddles of blood.
Puddles of blood, you know, pond, puddles. And what's happened is that it's the right distance of my head and my belly. If I lie down on it, I knew that would be the right. So my head lies on it and my belly lies on it, on the second one.
What is the significance of that for you?
Well, it's very much significant of life, really, but it's also, it's very much about, because the overall image is very static, except you notice things, like the belly breathes. And when I saw the belly, when I saw the video, you know, there's this kind of movement, you know, of life. It's like, I mean, obviously, you know, the belly is the gut, you know, it's this kind of, it's the gut. Also, and the head, you know, the head, it's just like, to me, it's just really beautiful images, you know, as visually, it's just, there's not really, apart from trust, apart from having this this, I wanted to create this image which was in my head, which I think is very beautiful, but also can, in our everyday life can be seen as tragic or as horrific, you know. The bell is also represent a pig being opened, you know, and this idea of, you know, your gut out, but also the idea of, you know, I find the idea that is also very, very beautiful, you know, very, very beautiful. It's metaphorical because it's about life, really, rather than death, although you're dealing with images which might be just depicting their horror. And the same, on the same level, it's not about death, it's not about tragedy, you know, it's about life, it's about, you know, it's very powerful images of being, you know, and also it's to me, obviously, it's about freedom, you know, yeah, you know, yeah.
You said all your performances are about freedom.
Yeah,
in some sense.
Yes, of course, yeah, I think so. All my performances are about freedom. When they work for me. Sometimes it can be quite frustrating, but in the sense that you think you're left thinking it wasn't what I wanted. It becomes more like theatre. Where at the moment I think the work, not that it really matter whatever that means. What theatre means, I don't know. But in my own language, I have a problem with things that are purely, obviously sometimes I lose the feeling, the emotional feeling, you know? In a sense, when I see the work or I'm making the work, I feel it. I feel, you know, very, very emotional. And that's when usually I know that there's something has ticked. You know, mm-hmm. If I don't feel that, then suddenly I'm there and thinking I'm getting bored. Then I realize something wrong. Mm-hmm. And this has happened. It has happened in the past. Not in the last year or so, but in performance, this has happened with my other work, in a sense. Because I also do installation work. But sometimes you do stuff and you just think you're just making stuff, you're just producing stuff. And sometimes you wonder whatever you're just doing it because... Just say, you know, it's just like, it's because it's that what you do, it's that, because that's what Franco B does, you know, makes art every day, you know.
It's all the production.
So, right? Sometimes I know when things are not special for me in a sense. But then when I saw the video of the last performance, I knew I made something special for me, you know, it was special for me. Certainly when I saw it, I realized that I'd done something which was very, very, very good, and it worked. You know, also, it's difficult. I mean, there's no such a thing as being honest, but I try to live my life and my work, you know, it's one thing. I try to do it with some kind of self-respect and try to be, at least try to be honest to myself in terms of what my reason, what is my, you know, what is my need, try to understand, and this is one of my needs, you know, is to do what, you know, it's very much about, I want to make this work, I want to, you know, I'm a performance artist, I'm an artist, I'm somebody that needs to be creative, that to be able to carry on, really.
Yes, you talked about survival,
mm.
Can you say a word about what you mean by survival?
Survival is very much about survival, you know, survival is the word, you know, survival is about... Surviving life in a way which I think gives me, you know, some kind of self-respect of who I am, because I grew up without all that. You know, obviously I grew up where I didn't have self-respect, and so on. And suddenly one day, you know, okay, slowly, it took time. Obviously, I didn't know what I wanted to do 18 years ago, but slowly, I just. By trusting myself and by letting myself go and letting go of things which obviously were very much part of society paranoia, you know, by education, you know, like, you know, what I was supposed to do with my life, what is right to do in your life, and so on, you know, things everybody has to face. And, you know, obviously, I decided one day, you know, I was never happy, So, you know, if you're not happy, you do something about it. You try other things. Either you do that or you kill yourself, you know? So in a sense, or you kill yourself, but not so much physically. And I'm not saying kill yourself by just, you know, I'm not saying by suicide.
You made your but life also, sort of living death.
Yes, of course. That's what I mean. And so suddenly I realized, you know, I do want to live, and I want to, if I'm going to live, I want to do with self, I want to do with some kind of dignity, self-respect, you know. And I started, you know, in a way I started to trust myself, and I started not to feel ashamed about letting out these signals.
Did you find this confidence to let go while you were still doing your degree at Chelsea, or did afterwards?
No, the point is that there's different way of doing things like that. The point is, at first I was very angry. So my hunger was the main vehicle for that, although maybe it wasn't direct in a way which I knew exactly what I was doing with it. It was good for me because I had this kind of period where I saw the art college as a pure as a ground where I could do all these things and not worry about it. I could try things. To me, was, you know, I was there to learn. I was there to experiment. I was there to fuck up, you know. So I had this attitude that I didn't have anything to lose. College for me was very useful to a degree that, because I was very angry, but also, I was angry, but I didn't waste it. I'm very interested, you know, I'm also very much interested in this in language, you know, in how one can use language, you know.
And, do you mean verbal language or body language?
No, body language, but also language as a whole, language which is not necessarily just what I say, it's not something which is in a vacuum, you know. It's not a language, it's not an art language, a language which is, when you know, a language which is universal, you know. It's like walking down the street and you see, you know, you look at the sky, you know, you see scape, you see a big something that moves you, you know.
When you were talking about the limited space and you in it,
yeah.
A quick flash of a Francis Bacon painting.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And we talked on the phone last time about Francis Bacon.
Oh yeah.
With whom your name has a certain strange similarities.
One cannot escape life, you know, and it's very much about that. I think in a way, whatever one is inspired by something, or purely is that the path across it, in a way, it's not so much about inspiring. It's like you say, oh, you influence, it's like the question will be, obviously you're influenced by Francis Bacon. In a sense, no disrespect to him. Yes, I am, in a way, probably I was, it's not so much being influenced by him, but when I saw his work, I ticked. It ticked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that made it more acceptable for me.
That would have
made it more acceptable. In a way, that would make it more, because it tick, you realize that you're the only one that's going through this process. Mm-hmm. That essentially, you know, everybody going through this process, and mm-hmm. that humanity as a whole, you know, has gone through this process for thousands of years.